You know, I always wonder, it's so amazing when I read history, to see how oppressed people are usually the most willing to compromise, the most forgiving, whereas the oppressor are the ones who are the most rigid in the defense of their privilege and who can hold a grudge the most. And certainly the history of Haiti illustrate that truth. As many of you know, Haitians rose up from horrendous slavery, the most terrible condition in the world, and Saint-Domingue was probably the worst of all, and proclaimed their freedom in 1794. At the time, they were led by Toussaint Louverture, and they did not say that all the ex-masters had to leave the island. They did not propose to kill them all. They simply said that there will no longer be slavery and that the fruit of work should be shared in a more fair way. And what was proposed by Louverture was a third for the emerging state, a third for the workers, and a third for the owners, which was incredibly generous since the owners had stolen the land. And yet, instead of accepting this generous compromise, what happened is that Napoleon sent an expeditionary force to reinstate slavery, a force that committed untold atrocity. You know, that's where gassing people started. They would take the slaves, put them in a sheep hold and burn sulfur to suffocate them. They would tie weight to their ankle and throw them alive in the sea. And the project, which we know about in a correspondence between Leclerc, who commanded that force and was Napoleon's brother-in-law, writing to Napoleon, he said, "I plan to exterminate all the Negroes of the mountain, a third of the Negroes in the plain, and all those who had bore arms at one point or another during the conflict." So you see, when I say that the oppressor is the most rigid in the defense of its privilege to oppress and can hold a grudge for very long. France has held that grudge against Haiti for more than 200 years, as we've seen in February of 2004. So after the French succeeded in capturing Louverture, deporting him in France, and actually, you know, forcing him to really die by attrition in the coldest part of France, in jail, the slave rose up again, but this time, of course, they wanted more. This time they wanted not only freedom, but they wanted independence from France. And they fought, and during the war, a third of the population was killed. So it was some serious, fierce war. And the independence of Haiti was proclaimed on January 1st, 1804. Haiti took as its motto, "In unity there is force." and also freedom, equality, and brotherhood. That was the Haitian dream back in 1804. We can see today that this dream has turned into something of a nightmare. Whenever you hear about Haiti, the word Haiti triggers a sentence: the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere. Whenever you say Haiti, it goes, the poorest country of the Haitian, of the Western Hemisphere. And there is truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. If you look at the numbers, it is the poorest country. But that doesn't take into account the great quality of the Haitian people and the potential the land still has. But I won't get into that. I won't try and diminish the stark reality that is Haiti. But we are going to try and understand how come the richest colony of France, who brought more in terms of riches to France than all the British colonies put together, how come it is today the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere? How did that happen, and who is responsible? I'll tell you who is not responsible. It is the Haitian peasant who has worked this land using almost his bare hands and has produced for close to a century and a half since independence. And of course, before independence, the Haitian slaves were producing the totality of the wealth. But after independence, it was the descendant of the slave working the land who produced all the riches that created the cities, that created the new merchant, that fed and armed the generals. So in that failure, the Haitian peasant, the Haitian masses have no responsibility. You know, all the elites in Haiti keep saying, it's a collective sin. We're all responsible. No, we're not all responsible. I might be responsible because I've had the privilege of going to school, of having a roof over my head, and I consider myself part of these elites. But I know that the Haitian peasant is not responsible. He's the victim of that constant degradation of the Haitian dream. Among those who are responsible, there are international actors and there are national, local actors. I'll start first with the national actors, because as an old Marxist, I believe that the internal contradictions are always more important. There is a saying in Haiti that says, if si an dan pa tab vann, deyò pa ta kapab achete, which translates as, if those inside were not willing to sell, those outside couldn't buy. In other words, if your brother wasn't willing to sell you, nobody could buy you. So I think whatever harm has been done by foreign powers to Haiti always went through Haitian accomplices and usually members of the so-called intellectual or economic or political elites. What did happen after independence? I always say that nobody had land, nobody had fabricated land, In fact, everybody has been brought over either as slave master or as slave. The land, if it belonged to anybody, belonged to the Arawak's Indians, who had been completely eliminated by the Spanish. So the land belonged in equal portions to every Haitian. And it was at the time the only asset that we had. But what happened is that the generals of the Haitian army and the free blacks and mulattoes who had had the chance to study decided they would adopt the same economic system that the colonialists had applied, namely large plantation for intensive cultivation of commodities to be exported in exchange for imported goods. Whereas, of course, the vast majority of Haitians would not own land, but would work these huge properties as workers, landless workers. Whereas the dream of the ex-slave was to own his own piece of land and work it, producing first what was needed to feed his family, and the rest would be available for commerce. And this was two different ways of seeing the future of Haiti. That is at the economic level. But also, the first Haitian elites made the mistake, you know, that is very common amongst oppressed people, is to think that the system that had oppressed you, or the civilization that had oppressed you for so long, is in fact superior, and that you should try to reproduce it, even if, you know, you kick out the old master, but then you adapt his system, because you say, you know, if they were able to beat us, if they were able to subjugate us, it's because their system is better. So that's how these elites tailored their political system, tailored their educational system on the French model. And that's why French was made the official language of Haiti. Imagine adopting the language of an enemy that you have vanquished, that tells you right there, you know, the type of alienation, the cultural alienation that these elites suffered from. And because of that divorce between the elites and the masses, very early on, conflict started in the new nation state. And it was, first of all, a conflict about land. Around 1843, or 46, I might be off by a couple of years now, the Haitian president of the time, under threat by France, accepted to pay the French a huge amount of money to compensate for the losses of the French colonists, because of independence. This is unheard of in the history of humanity, that slaves stand up to their masters, and pardon the expression, kick their ass, and then have to pay them compensation. So that's what France was able to extract under threat, but also we must say with the complicity of the then president of Haiti and of the elite of Haiti. Why I say that? It's because France was threatening, but France did not at the time have the power to actually carry out the threats. And it would have been impossible if the divorce between the elites and the masses had not already been so advanced. As a matter of fact, what was decided by the Haitian elite was that rather than fight on two fronts, fighting our own people demanding land and having to watch our back for the French, we better deal with the French, and that will free our hands to deal with our own people to quell the rebellion, the peasant rebellion that were occurring in that country. So here you see, you know, the interplay between the external enemy of the dream of Haitian people and the internal enemy. And that debt completely, you know, crushed the young nation. It took Haiti 100 years to repay that debt. And that is why President Aristide, in what was a correct demand, asked that France reimburse that money with interest and all. And that was the basis of the campaign that he launched for reparation. I say it was a just demand, but maybe it wasn't one that was done at the right time or wisely, because that only made the French more furious and accelerated their participation in the conspiracy that will give us February 29, 2004. But truly, the impact of that debt extracted by France cannot be overemphasized. You know, it truly rendered Haiti a moribund dream from the beginning. Then all through the 19th century also, countries like England, Germany would send their gunship to Haiti and extract huge reparation for their national who had supposedly been hurt by some event in Haiti. You know, they would send their gunship. They would also trade in precious wood. And you hear about deforestation, you know, it didn't start like 2 years ago or 4 years ago. It's something that started way back then, and in which those who participated and made money were these foreign countries and the economic elite of and political elite of Haiti. And of course, last but not least, amongst the culprits are the new kid on the block who has become the giant that we know, the USA. You know about the Monroe Doctrine, when Monroe declared that from now on, America to the Americans, and of course he meant America to the Yankees, because we are all American. Whether we live in the West Indies, you know, in Chile, we're all American. But when they said America to the American, they didn't see it that way. They meant America to the United States of America. At any rate, they invaded Haiti, as well as other countries in the region, the Dominican Republic, Honduras, etc. And not only did they completely unsettled Haiti, unsettled its agriculture, but, and of course, steal the gold that Haiti had accumulated in its central bank, took over the customs, and had a ball for 20 years. They then, after having established their predominance on Haiti, they left us a poison gift that was called the army, and which was not at all the army that had fought for independence and for the integrity of Haiti, but was a proxy for the U.S. Marines. They were to take over the duty of the U.S. Marines as an occupying army. And we've seen that happen in the DR, where Trujillo became the head of that, the equivalent in the Dominican Republic. We saw it in Nicaragua, with Somoza being the first commander of that so-called national army, replacing the U.S. Marines. At any rate, what is the situation today, as we speak? And when I say today, I'm not yet talking about post last February the 7th election. First of all, you know the terrible numbers, right? 4% of the population controlling 60% of the wealth. One doctor for 10,000 people, and that's not even true because most of them stay in Port-au-Prince. So it would be in the countryside, maybe one doctor for 25,000 people. 50% of Haitians can't read nor write. Of those Haitian children who attend school attend private school. So in that sense, Haiti is one of the most privatized nations of the world. There is no public transportation as such. All of it is private, or almost all of it. I'll point out to a few exceptions later. You might say security. Public security is also a private affair, because as we speak, the number of private security agents is much higher than the number of policemen. Water distribution. Most Haitians have, and the poorest, have to buy water from private company who go and pump the water out of the common groundwater reserves that belong, of course, to the nation, pump it up, fill their truck, and go in the poor neighborhood and sell that by the bucketful or by the gallonful. So water distribution is also private. I once wrote an article where I said that the way to get rich in Haiti is to take over a function that is the sole responsibility of the state. You're sure to make money. So, that is the situation. And yet, we are being pushed by the IMF, the Banque Mondiale, World Bank, and of course by the US and the G8 to reduce the size of the state. We got to privatize even more if we are to listen to them, you know. So what's going to remain? And then they're going to say, hey, there is a failed state. Haiti is a failed state. Of course, if you don't have a state, and it's obvious that the Haitian people do not buy into that version, nor that version of society with all this social divide that you cannot live with no longer, nor do they want that model of democracy that's based on excluding the weak, forgetting completely about solidarity and having only as a guiding light, you know, the efficiency. So they want more state. They want more state so that we have a true national education, so that every Haitian has the same start in life and has the same type of upbringing. They want more state so that they have access to health care, at least basic health care. They want more state so that they have access to drinkable water. And that's what they've been asking for. And they want a democracy of their own, because they can see that democracy is the only system where your culture enters into it, because it is government by the people. A dictator can be imported. A military dictator can go and impose his system. You know, he could be American and go to Nicaragua, and that has been done. He could be Chinese and go to some other country and impose his rule, and that has been done. But a democracy must reflect the people who put it up. Democracy in Sweden is quite different than it is in the US, if you can call that democracy. Democracy in India is not the same as democracy in France. Democracy must fit in with the culture and the dream of the people. And that's what the Haitian people have been demanding from 1986 on. At least from 1986, they've been screaming it. Before, they couldn't. But starting 1986, they've been screaming, that's what we are demanding. And every time, they've found people to block their way toward that achievement. But they did see, at least through a window, that it was possible. And I'm not here to defend either Jean-Bertrand Aristide or René Préval. But I'm here to set the record straight. And I can tell you, I did not, in the last election, campaign for Mr. Préval, but I did campaign for the right of the Haitian people to vote and pick their leaders themselves. That I campaigned for, but I never said vote prevailed. The Haitian people did elect him. But we must recognize that with Lavalas, the Lavalas movement was the movement that embodied all these demands of the Haitian masses for a new society, a society without exclusion, a society where all children could go to school as mandated by the Constitution, a society where people would at least have the minimum dignity that you have when you have work, when you have at least you can eat twice a day. I'm not even thinking about three times a day, but at least twice a day. And that's what Lavalas symbolized. And Lavalas was first, you could say, came together around the person of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and was Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected overwhelmingly, as you know, on December 16, 1990, and this election created a tremendous surge of hope, and with hope came the desire to transform and to embellish society. You know, had you been there or had the press shown you really what happened around that time, around the time that President Aristide was inaugurated the first time? You see, Port-au-Prince is one of the dirtiest cities in the world. Yet on the day of President Aristide's inauguration, you could eat off the street of Port-au-Prince. And it had all been done not by the state, not by hired people, but by the same people who had voted their president and who, with their bare hands, you know, and wheelbarrow and a couple of shovels, cleaned that place, decorated it, and made a huge celebration. You could see, you could feel the vibration, and you could see the potential that was there to finally build that country. 7 months later, the military, on order from the oligarchy and from their masters in Langley Forest, struck the new regime, sent President Aristide in exile, and killed about 5,000 Haitians who were opposing that coup. Despite that coup, the desire, the necessity for democracy was so strong that the Haitians resisted and resisted with their bare hands against the military, but with such determination that President Clinton had to bring President Aristide back in 1994. And we must say that those who judge the achievement of Lavalas never take into account those three terrible years of the coup. It's like they had never happened. It's like they had never completely destroyed the economy of the country and killed or gotten rid of by sending them into exile or buying them off with visas, the natural leader, the grassroots leaders that were emerging. And also by, you know, when you have momentum and they break it, when you have to start again, it's always more sluggish.